bring him back. Having lost my spouse, must I now pay an attorney?
Well, of course, if your only recourse is to institute proceedings, then that would be the best way to go in terms of retaining an attorney. You can institute proceedings yourself. The challenge, of course, is that you may not necessarily know exactly what to do. So that's why an attorney would be necessary. Mm-hmm. But one of the failings, as I said, of this legislation is that if everything was being properly done and the mm-hmm. individual dies, there isn't a real avenue for compensation.
And this is a follow-up. Again, this is from the WhatsApp. If a curfew is in my area and in effect I can't leave home to go to work because mm-hmm. it lasted a week mm-hmm. and it can only last 2 days.
Well, I can address that instance, as well.
Mm-hmm. I didn't attend work for the week and mm-hmm. so I was fired. What redress do I have in being reinstated?
Well, that's another consideration. The legislation actually does not make that type of provision for loss of employment as a result of the proper exercise of this curfew. And to be clear, the legislation itself provides that the curfew the curfew isn't to last more than 2 days. But at the same time, there is a bit of a gap or a loophole in which would allow the commissioner of police, for example, to go and get a new mandate for a further 2 days of a curfew. They simply have to go to the minister and get the minister's consent, and the 2 days can start again. Mm-hmm. So that ultimately there is a possibility that it can be extended beyond the 2 days, but in the first instance, the legislation only speaks to two.
And to give you another one, where is the Chief Justice's part in all of this law that is to be passed? It's already been passed. 7724, who wrote this? The police, as it is right now, are often accused and reprimanded for their abuse of power. And now this, we ain't Little England anymore. We will soon become Little Cuba. All right, I'll just leave that.
Yeah. There.
But the person is concerned that the police right now are often accused and reprimanded for their abuse of power. And he's wondering if the Chief Justice has any part of this legislation that has already been passed.
No, the Chief Justice is not involved in the preparation of legislation. There are three important arms of government which are very separate. The arm of government that passes legislation is responsible for that is the legislature. They make law. They make statutes. The second arm of government that is involved and is necessary is the executive. The governor general is functioning in her role as a member of the executive in having to essentially sign off on this legislation in order for it to become effective law. And that has not yet been done as far as I am aware. And then the Chief Justice is the head of the judiciary. And the judiciary is responsible for ensuring that laws are properly applied and constitutional motions can be done for the judiciary to determine whether a law is in accordance with the Constitution or not. And if it is not in accordance with the Constitution, then the judiciary has the power to declare that that law is not valid.
We go back to the phone lines because our calls are building up. Good afternoon, Rastak Sunday, you're on the air. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Rastak Sunday, you're on the air. Yes, you're on the air.
Good morning to you and your guests.
Yes, good afternoon. It's 12:03.
Good afternoon. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
We as Bajans are surviving in a system where the police, the lawyers, police, the lawyers, mm-hmm. the politicians, police, the politicians. And if we want to develop, we need to stop ruling by trial and error. Mm-hmm. We need an independent body of law-abiding citizens to monitor the actions of politicians, police, and lawyers. If I didn't know any better, I would believe that I am listening to a program this morning that is advertising lawyers. Many of us are in a position right now due to due to our fiscal deficit, which is a direct result of the mismanagement, as far as I'm concerned, based on the auditor, Auditor General's report. Mm-hmm. That is a fact. It's not something I made up or something I saw on social media. And we all know it. We cannot run this country on trial and error. There should have been consultations. Why should one man, Mr. David Commission, have to fight for all of us? When he goes to court, we all should go to court with him to support him. Because we've had enough. I've had enough. Because we are educated, or we brag about being a highly educated society. It's time we started acting like that. We have rights too, and we want them to be exercised. We've been ignored. The average law-abiding citizen in this country has been ignored. A police breaks into an old man's house. He's got the wrong house. He had the wrong information. That poor man has to go get a lawyer so he can have his door fixed. Give me a break. That's all I have to say. Thank you
very much. Would you like to respond, or you want me to move on? There is another WhatsApp here before I go to the phone. The amendments may ultimately be proven to be invasive, disproportionate, and injurious to innocent parties. It may also serve to initiate actions which are arbitrarily exercised by officers of the law to the detriment of the wider community. Disproportionately negative externalities may arise and be compounded by custom and practice. Another opinion. We go back to the phone lines. This is Brass Tack Sunday. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sanka.
Yes, good afternoon, sir.
How are you doing? And your guest. Listen, I have a little contribution. It's my view, my feeling, right, that a government that in its dying days, there should be a law that prevents that government from making changes to the Constitution or bringing new laws or amending laws in its dying days, unless in a state of emergency. Because I don't think a lot of these things have been thought through seriously. And one other thing I want to say, in terms of the cell phone law, why is it that you cannot wear an earpiece? Not earphones, an earpiece that is paired to your phone. Mm-hmm. And the only thing you have to do to take that call is to touch your ear. It's not against law to drive with one hand. It's not against law to touch your ear. That's all. You would just be able to take a call. I mean, there are some special ones that can also make a call with using your voice. But you should be allowed to use a simple earpiece. Why? Now tell me, if this law was thought through, why can't you do that?
I can't speak, obviously, to the considerations, the specific considerations that were made in creating the legislation, but one of the concerns I imagine would be that if you're using the earpiece, there may be some level of impairment of your ability to hear out of that ear while you're wearing that earpiece. Whereas, by comparison, if you're using it through your radio or whatever, there is no potential for blockage. There's no possibility for hearing in one particular ear to be impaired over the other. As I said, I can't speak to the specifics. That's the only thing that I can think of which could have informed that particular decision.
But you have two ears.
Yes, you do. But obviously, you should have as much of your faculties. You should have as much of your faculties as you possibly can to limit distractions. So that's the only. As I said, that's the only thing that I can.
So my question is, when it comes through loud, through your car stereo speakers, right? Both of your ears picking it up.
Yes, but of course, at the same time, you should be reasonable and rational and not have your stereo at a point where you can't hear anything else.
I understand that.
Right.
But it just boggles my mind why you cannot use the earpiece.
I understand that. Earphone. I actually have heard other people.
Let me come here. I was actually once stopped by police some years ago because I did have an earpiece. Mm-hmm. And the officer in question, very, very, very nice, and a lot of people who I've met in the police force execute their duties in a very considerate manner, and that needs to be said. But anyhow, this young man told me, you're not supposed to have that in your ear. And he explained to me that it's part of, well, first of all, it's against the law. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that it's a distraction. And so he took my name, he took my car number, he looked at my license and everything, and he told me I may be prosecuted. Now, that was, well, 6 years ago, so I would guess
should
he...
should be any clearer now. He,
right? But the point is that this is nothing new. Mm. This is nothing new at all. And I, just like you, always wondered why, you know, because to my mind, it was okay, it was safe. But as he said, it's against the law. So that's it.
Right. So this time when they amended the law, mm-hmm. they still allow the provision for the earpiece. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's simple.
Well, again, if there was consultation, national consultation, and forgive me, listeners, if I continue to say this ad nauseum, because I strongly believe that I think majority of Barbadians would look at this law, despite all its provisions, which are pretty harsh. I think a lot of Barbadians, if they were consulted appropriately and they were told of the sort of dangers that that are really existing out there, that they would even consent to this law. But people need to be consulted. People need to be asked, or rather to be told, look, this is the reason why we're doing this. Instead, what has happened is that the law came up, and then it became a situation where it was my side defending an issue as against the national interest being looked at. That is my perspective. Ms. Turton may have a different perspective.
My, as I said, I can only speak to the position in relation to the Bar Association, and we believe that we can play a crucial role in assisting any government in framing appropriate legislation and just making sure that it contains adequate provision for the public. As I said, we have been consulted in relation to other pieces of legislation before, and we would just want it to be on a more consistent basis so that when it actually is passed, all potential angles have been considered.
Sanka?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that is the reason why, say, a government on its dying legs should not be able to rush legislation into parliament. It should not be allowed to. Because it comes too half-baked, you know? Neither cooked nor raw. Anyway, you have a nice day.
Yes, sir. You too. Speaking about, let's just move off of the, let's go on to the Road Traffic Amendment Act. And I have a WhatsApp here. Are you Bajans aware that this government has passed a law that subjects you to a maximum penalty of 18 months in prison if you are found even holding your cell phone while operating your motor vehicle on any public road? And they did so without consulting you or discussing it with you in any way. And nobody even raises their voice to protest over this. Yesterday, I was expecting a very important telephone call. Three times while I was driving my car, my cell phone rang. On each occasion, I picked up the cell phone to see if it was the important call I was anticipating. If it turned out to be that call, my intention was to pull off the road and take the call. It is only this morning, after reading the text of the new law, that I realized to my shock and horror that I had committed three criminal offenses that could have inflicted upon me an 18-month term of imprisonment in each case. And this WhatsApp that I'm reading is from an attorney.
Yes, that's correct. The penalty is quite harsh. It's a fine of $2,000 or imprisonment for a term of 18 months or both. Now, obviously, one of the main things that people must note is that those are maximum penalties. So only in the most extreme of circumstances would that be imposed. But I find it difficult to imagine a scenario in which simply driving while even speaking on your phone, having it to your ear, would justify a term of 18 months in prison. We have something called the Penal System Reform Act, and that piece of legislation exists to ensure rehabilitation of offenders and to limit imprisonment to the most severe and serious of circumstances. And I just can't imagine a scenario in which serving a term of 18 months in prison would ever be appropriate in relation to driving with your cell phone. For example, if you were driving with your phone to your ear, and as a result of doing that, you collided with another vehicle or you struck a child and the child died, then the type of penalty that would be imposed on you would not be based on driving with your cell phone. You could be charged with causing death by dangerous driving, and that carries a term of imprisonment of about, I think it's 10 years. And that is what you would be being punished for, driving in a way which is so reckless and dangerous that you caused the death of someone. Or if the person didn't die and you injured them or what have you, you can be charged with reckless driving, you can be charged with dangerous driving. Those are the types of offenses that should attract that type of penalty. But this seems extremely high for simply using a cell phone. I understand the aim of it, of course, which is to deter persons from doing that, to deter persons from being distracted in a way that can cause an accident. And I understand the nature of the provision, but the penalty, I would agree, is quite harsh. And also, the caller, the person who sent the message, is correct in terms of the fact that simply holding your phone means you've committed the offense. I picked up my phone when it was a day earlier this week to be charged. And it occurred to me in that moment, technically, I've committed an offense. And that is what it is.
Looking at the Road Traffic Amendment Act, one of the complaints that I had, and I had this out with the minister here on brass tacks as well, that there was a need for a ticketing system to be put in place. Because my argument then, and I still feel very strongly about this, is that it made absolutely no sense to bring in this new law, which has some, and I must add, the Road Traffic Amendment Act has some great new provisions. It does take into account a number of things that needed to be done, and it's very positive in those ways. But having said that, you also don't have a ticketing system. Mm-hmm. So therefore, what you have effectively done is that you're going to charge people like you charge them now, and then you're going to throw them into a system that is backlogged with over 10,000 cases already, mm-hmm. which makes to me no absolute sense. And I always felt that there should be a ticketing system. To my amazement in the House of Assembly, of all the people who would also suggest that this should have been done, was the Attorney General. In fact, I'll just read what he said in commenting on the whole thing. Mr. Brathwaite said that preset fines for traffic offences would have enabled offending motorists to quickly pay their monies and get on with their daily lives instead of having to join long queues waiting on their cases to be called at the magistrate's court. And, you know, this is the thing that bothers me about some of these laws. This haste. The Road Traffic Amendment Act in particular, I can't deal with the Police Amendment Act, but the Road Traffic Amendment Act in particular is going to impact people's lives on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I would have thought that we would have had that level of consultation with this. Because if we've had that level of consultation, I'm sure people would have suggested, because I certainly would have attended and say, we should have fines. Mm-hmm. because people have found a way to deal, you know, to get around the backlog that we have right now in the system.
Well, the backlog itself is significant. And the truth is that even for traffic offenses, there's a substantial amount of time that the police and the courts have to apply in dealing with these matters. We would agree that a ticketing system would be an appropriate alternative to limit the amount of judicial time that is spent on it, as long as there is also provision, for example, for the individual to challenge the ticket, which would then require them to still go before a judicial officer, which in this case would be a magistrate. Another consideration, though, even if a ticketing system was established, it would still have to take into consideration the administrative processes mm-hmm. that would have to exist to facilitate that. Persons, of course, would have to be hired to, you'd have to make sure there was adequate staffing to take the payments, that there was adequate staffing to organize how tickets are issued, how they are processed, and what about persons who are issued with a ticket, much like now, who are not, who do not comply, they don't pay the ticket. Mm-hmm. Someone has to be present to follow up on those and to cause that person to come to court when they don't pay the ticket. So there's still those challenges that have to be considered. I'm not sure if that has affected the government's ability to impose that particular provision, but there are complexities to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, a question being asked here, and I think in the light of what we're discussing here, mm-hmm. is that when this legislation has been, well, in terms of the case of the Road Traffic Act, has been proclaimed, what provision is there that it can be changed again by a new government?
The legislature, who is made up of the government and the opposition, can amend any piece of legislation that has been imposed. So if after this next election, well, actually, no matter what, there will be a new government. And that government has the power to amend any piece of legislation. In fact, what we are looking at is an amendment in and of itself. This is not an act that has been now been established. This is an amendment to the regulations, an amendment to the Road Traffic Act. That can be amended. Mm-hmm. So there is provision for that. And I imagine that once the public makes its concerns known and those are taken into consideration, and the legislation has been in operation and certain issues have been raised, that amendments may flow to make it more effective and fair and reasonable and just.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, I must point out that although we are talking here about the recent legislation, we will also be fielding questions on some of your concerns about attorneys. And we've had a couple so far, and I'll just move on here and deal with a couple more because it's now 12:22. We have 8 minutes before the latest. And before I do that, let's go to the phone lines first. Good afternoon, Brassac Sunday.
Yeah, good afternoon, Mr. Price and lady guest.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I want to make a quick comment on this cell phone legislation. Mm-hmm. And personally, I think it's a bit too drastic at this time of legislation as far as I'm concerned. That's being pushed right now, that's been legislated. I will use the word draconian. First thing, the penalty is too high. I don't see it should be more than $250 at maximum, mm-hmm. Basic for $50, $250, and this possibility, as you thought I was saying a little before about this 80 months in prison. This is rather too drastic. I know that they want to make the public, bring it home to the public that this is a problem and we need to deal with it. Mm-hmm. But I have said to the government, really, I think they've been busy. I take the word. They've allowed themselves to be, I don't know. I use the word busy. With this legislation, at this time, with this cell phone move. So I hope they they'll look at it, they'll look at, maybe look at, think about looking at it again. I think for taxi drivers, again, that it is too drastic. You know, taxi drivers, that tool, the cell phone is a tool or the job. Mm-hmm. And to be bombarded with the possibility of, as soon as you pick that phone and put it in your ear, mm-hmm. that police come and lets you and put, you know, pull you over for driving without due care to catch attention. It's totally unnecessary for the taxi. Like, I mean, it should be so, in this thing, apart from the fact that the price, the penalty is too high, it should be a special provision for taxi fellows, like taxi drivers, taxi operators, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. So I'm disappointed that the government at this time, that I support, really, that would allow themselves to be mizzled with this thing, and then not put it back, maybe allow it to think it over some more, and allow a little more time, because there's no emergency. There's no emergency to me in this country that this kind of thing has to be pushed at this time. Mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of other things that contribute to a lot of the accidents, that especially the bad hits that occur,
right.
Like the smooth roads, the educated drivers as to how to use the roads,
mm-hmm.
Especially when the roads are damp a little bit, and all that kind of stuff, a whole lot of different stuff. And you know, it's always bringing a lot of legislation. I some of it's necessary, but
mm-hmm.
I think it has to be timely, and I don't think it's really timely right now. And the government should really not pursue so strongly some of these things. And next thing you're going to hear about is breathalyzer testing and all that kind of stuff. Again, I think when it comes, it's going to be, again, something that is not necessary to push so hard for what's happening at this time. Don't make yourself unpopular, this Democratic Labour Party government. Try to stay on top of things, okay? That's my comment, okay?
At the moment, there are exceptions which are provided in the legislation for the use of emergency vehicles, such as ambulances, police vehicles, Barbados Defense Force vehicles, Department of Emergency Management, Fire Service, and Prison Service. Those persons are permitted to use their cell phones in the ordinary manner in cases of emergency once they're acting in the course of their employment. And perhaps it would be reasonable for taxi drivers to advocate for the reason why they should be included in that particular exception. In relation to the penalty, as I indicated, we do consider that the penalty is quite high, but of course the other question is whether or not there is a necessity for this at this time. It is a reasonable provision. One of the ways that the legislature acts is to try to affect human behavior and the behavior of the citizens by imposing penalties for certain types of behavior, such as driving with or without a seatbelt. And I imagine that's what their aim was, but perhaps reconsideration could be given to the penalty to reduce it, because it may be sufficient for a fine at a lower level to deter people from acting in a way which could be dangerous to other road users.
Welcome back to Brass Tack Sunday, brought to you with the compliments of Williams Industries Incorporated. For business supplies, big or small,
at Williams Metals, we have it all. Now is the time for you to fence your property with galvanized green, white, or brown chain link fencing and our brown band galvanized pole pipes, which are the longest lasting. We will give you a free estimate too on all your fencing material. For business supplies, big or small, at Williams
Metals, we have it. Visit their website at www.williamsmetals.bb.
And this is Sanka Price here with Ms. Kristen Turton, the Honorary Secretary of the Bar Association. We've been looking at some of the concerns that the bar had with the legislation that has been passed recently. But we also have questions about lawyers as well, and we have quite a few. And we're going to start with that. We go to our WhatsApp. This conversation is interesting, and yes, what that guy said is indeed true regarding dishonest lawyers. who may be disbarred. But what happens after this is done by the Bar Association? How does the individual who has been robbed by the lawyer retrieve the money which the lawyer has not paid to the client?
Okay, well, the Bar Association itself doesn't necessarily make provision for full repayment. What has happened actually recently, the Court of Appeal would have made a decision in relation to an attorney who was suspended, and that particular attorney would have been suspended for a period of 18 months, I believe, or such longer period as it would take for that attorney to repay the client in full. So that sometimes the Court of Appeal, in making the decision about whether to disbar or suspend, will make an order for the payment of compensation. Other than that, there is a compensation fund that exists that lawyers, that all lawyers must contribute to at the beginning of every year. The fund is not as large as it should be, or rather as it, I suppose it could be. But a claim can be made against the fund by a client who has suffered a loss in a situation of dishonesty. And the Bar Association can allot a portion of that fund to satisfy part of the individual's claim. Of course, if the claim is a substantial one, the bar would not be in a position to make a payment in relation to the entire fund, but at least something can be returned. And the individual also has the option of instituting proceedings against the particular attorney to recover those funds in any event. There are attorneys who have been prepared to institute proceedings against other attorneys in situations like that. And those are really the three main avenues that an individual who has suffered that type of loss would have.
I have a question here. Someone wants to know, does the Bar Association put the names of the people who have been disciplined in any sort of way?
No, there's no particular list of attorneys who would have been disciplined, because the majority of complaints actually have nothing to do with what I think the majority of the society is concerned about. The majority of complaints to the disciplinary committee concern lack of communication by attorneys, or not knowing what is happening with their matters, not necessarily a situation in which money is taken by an attorney, which I think is by and large the main concern. But when an attorney is disciplined by way of a suspension or disbarment, which is usually the most appropriate form of discipline for something as serious as taking a client's money, that the Court of Appeal makes that determination, and those decisions are always published in the newspaper, so that the name of the individual, the period of suspension, or the penalty of the imposition of a disbarment is made known to the public. And as far as I can recall, on every occasion I've seen it, it's either been on the front page or the back page. So in a position for all members of the public to see, but there's no formal list as far as that is concerned.
All right. Someone here is also questioning, I have three calls back. Let me go to the phone lines first, deal with the call, and then I'll come back to this. You're on Brass Sack Sunday. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Price and Ms. Durden.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Price, glad you mentioned that some youngsters hiding in the old people's places. You know,
I was in court twice with two separate cases with that. And, I really felt for the elderly person involved.
Yeah.
So I know what I'm talking about. Anyhow,
anybody would tell you that one of the hardest things anybody could do is to try to defend against me. They don't know anything about a dog. They don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, we live in what they call the international community. And this curfew thing seems to might go a little bit deeper. I give an example. Two examples. You can see the first one here. If you Google the New York Times, then you put Chalabi, dies at 71. You see it right up there about a man who gave false information, which actually led to the war in Iraq. As a matter of fact, it was on CBC Channel 8 when he died. He said the information he gave was bogus. What if an outside country gives information to our government, which is bogus, and they act on it? What recourse does the person have? Because right now, Trinidad is taking information from these same people down in Iraq. And the Hudson Institute has an intelligence consultant called Mr. Michael Friesen, who shows that these people are involved in criminal militias. you know, what recourse would we and Barbados have? The second example is China. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it was on the BBC. China, even if you apply to go to China for anything, including visa for being a tourist, they use your photograph and they put it in there on the database. Mm-hmm. What if you have an activist here who says something against China, and then China decides to retaliate against one of our citizens? What recourse do we have? Caribbean Court of Justice, or what do we do?
Well, the Caribbean Court of Justice only governs issues in relation to members of CARICOM. So there wouldn't be any remedy as far as that is concerned. And to be honest, I can't really think of what the specific remedy would be under any form of international law.
I know, that's precisely what we're saying.
It doesn't mean that one doesn't exist. It just means that I'm not in a position to see
I understand. Right. Even when the yeah, because I understand the Caribbean Court just doesn't have any that right. kind of reach. But can they consult with other people? Can you go to them and consult with other people who do have that jurisdiction?
I can't imagine what role they would be able to play in that. That would have to be governed by international treaties and so on, and arrangements between governments.
Yeah. In closing, let me tell you something right now. The Chinese government did not even inform their own people that they were taking their own photographs. You know how they did it? It might be what Charles Morris said about what Hitler said. This is what was reported by our journalist. He said that they brought it into China. They finally did an entertainment park in Beijing where they made the people show their faces for Christmas reckoning just to get toilet paper. And that's how they eased it in. Then all of a sudden they came and said now that their police are using it in special glasses to track down people. You know, this, we live in a very dangerous world. I wish that we had some recourse against some of these criminal governments around the world. You have a good afternoon.
Thank you very much. Have another one here. Good afternoon to you and your guests. I've had a situation where a lawyer who was transferring a name on a deed on a joint to a joint owner, and the lawyer charged $10,000. When questioned, he says that it's the same as a sale. He was dismissed from the job. Another lawyer charged $22,000 to administer the probate of an estate. This person wants to know how lawyers can get away with this sort of thing.
Well, I'm not sure it's a matter of getting away with anything. There are specific fees, there are minimum fees. For those types of transactions, there are minimum fees that are charged, and the fee is charged based on the value of the asset. So the value of the land being transferred is what is the gauge for the minimum fee. Obviously, the more complex the transaction, the greater the likelihood that there will be an increase in that fee to take that into consideration. In relation to grants of probate and so on, it's the same type of calculation where the estate's value is what determines the fee. And as I said, it's a minimum fee which is calculated based on the estate. That fee normally ranges overall between making the application to the court and then actually advising on administering the estate. That can range somewhere between 3% and 5% in total based on the value of the estate. But it's a scale of fees which is applied in making that determination. And I can't speak to it, obviously, in the absence of more details.
Where would the public find that scale of fees?
The bar has a record of that scale of fees. Every attorney should have one. I'm not sure if it's available online at this time. I can't say that, but it is actually a part of the laws of Barbados. But I can't say that it's available online. It used to be, I believe, along with other pieces of legislation.
It's 12:49. We go back to the phone lines. Good afternoon. Brass Tack Sunday, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Sanka.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Mm-hmm. Let me make two comments. The first comment I want to make is with respect to the legislation about cell phone use and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Now, there is absolutely nothing wrong with saying that you have to put, if you want to be able to use a cell phone in your car, that you have to have a hands-free device, make it a hands-free device. Mm-hmm. If you are a taxi operator and your business is in your car, it serves your interest to get a hands-free device installed on your car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That makes perfect common sense to me. So therefore, the argument that we are getting the blowback again, and this thing that, maybe taxi operators have to be excluded or included in another piece of legislation or whatever to say that they're allowed to use cell phones. Because that is ridiculous. Simply get the hands-free device installed in your car if you have a need to use a cell phone in a car. That's the first thing. Okay? With respect to the charge, though, as far as I'm concerned, that is really excessive.
And you mean really the penalty?
The penalty.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is totally outrageous. Mm-hmm. And that brings me then to the second part of there are three parts, three things I want to ask. But the second part of the question of that there is like, who drafts these pieces of legislation? Because as far as I'm concerned, they're drafted by lawyers. And you're telling me that these lawyers, who are members of the Bar Association by law, are drafting pieces of legislation that make no sense. Okay? That they're doing it, I can't understand how they're doing it in the process, in a vacuum or what have you. The whole purpose of the Attorney General is supposed to act as the advisor to government in all that matters. And doing the drafting of legislation comes out of his office. So I do not understand how, after all of that has been done, the same Attorney General could stand up and say, well, this hasn't been included and they don't understand why or all that sort of nonsense. That makes absolutely no sense to me. Okay? Now, let's put aside all of that. That's one set of comments I want to make. Next one, I want to deal with a lawyer. I heard a clip just now in which it was said that the Bar Association is there to protect the public. And that was what I had thought up to a few months ago. And in an argument with a friend of mine who is a lawyer, she quickly disabused me of that notion. I said, no, the Bar Association is there to protect the interests of lawyers. The Bar Association is a union, just like any other operation, and they are to protect the interests of their members, not of the public.
Mm-hmm.
They're two totally different things.
Well, I mean,
that's a second. Hold on. I know you might.
I can address that directly.
Go ahead. Then.
Okay. The individual sports, as you said, is an attorney, but the Barbados Bar Association Act and the rules to that act govern what is the mandate of the association. And Rule 2 specifies that at paragraph D, that one of the aims and objects of the Bar Association is to improve the administration of justice and procedure and trial by jury. And at paragraph F, to promote and support law reform, law revision, and law reporting. So that while we are an association of attorneys, and yes, we must take steps to ensure that the interests of our members are protected, we have a wider mandate. And that mandate includes what I just pointed to. That would include things like this, in terms of saying this piece of legislation can be improved upon in the interest of justice, or in the interest of ensuring that all members of the public are properly and adequately protected, that the Constitution is adhered to. That is all part and parcel of our mandate.
Okay, I can't read what, from what you just told me.
Yes.
I don't read the additional aspect of the protection of the public in there. I read that is the protection of the, to make sure that the laws of the Constitution or whatever.
But the administration of justice is part and parcel of protecting the public. Of justice,
but hold up, just a second. I have not.
Sorry.
Listening to what you said, as far as I am concerned, right? That is not specifying talking about the public interest. That is still that is taking care of the lawyers and the methods or whatever, the environment in which they operate. I'm making sure that that's protected, okay? And the integrity of that is protected. Where is it say specifically about public? I don't see any of that. But anyhow, that is a matter of interpretation, okay? Because, as I said, that point was made to me by a respected attorney, okay? And I found I could not argue with her on that.
Well, as I said, I would respectfully disagree. that they had respectfully disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Not a problem. But you see, it brings me then into the second part where you're talking about the fact that we were talking, you're just talking about the scale of fees.
Yes.
And the fact that there is the scale of fees that exists that each attorney is supposed to have, yet you are not aware that this scale of fees is on a website or in some place which is easily accessible to the public. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if the priority of the Bar Association was to protect the interests of the public, then they would be in their interest
mm-hmm.
to make sure that a scale of fees mm-hmm. is easily available for all Bajans to be able to readily refer to. And then they can also draw that, they can take that scale of fees to any attorney that they have, that they are, again, I'm going to be double something else as well, in terms of the fact that people are forced to use attorneys in a lot of different situations in Barbados.
Mm.
And particularly in the States, when you
well, everywhere.
That they have moved away, pardon me?
Everywhere.
That in the States now, you've seen that they've moved away to a great degree mm-hmm. in terms of a lot of these things that you need to employ attorneys for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in order to do things, carry out certain transactions and that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not seen any move in Barbados to reduce the dependence of attorneys on attorneys, by mm-hmm. the general public. So all these things are, as far as I'm concerned, in the interest of the public and which are not held as a priority for the Bar Association to make sure that this is done. Okay, so therefore, although you could tell me, yes, it's in our mandate that the public has to be protected, I am not seeing any evidence of this. And particularly when you have so many complaints being registered now, if one of them, against attorneys, and so many complaints, people calling in all the time with all the horror stories, saying, well, listen, they've had matters being held by their attorneys that have been taken X amount of years, and they do not feel that they have any adequate redress or compensation against it. The mere mm-hmm. fact that you don't put our, you said, well, when we were asked, well, is there a list of attorneys who have been disciplined or whatever? So therefore, there's nothing that protects the public from going to an attorney who might have been formally disciplined for several matters. Okay, because unknown to the new person, the client that comes in, they don't know the history of that attorney. And there's nothing that protects the public against that. So although you might say, yes, it is within the mandate of the Bar Association to protect the public, I have not seen evidence of that. And even if it does exist, it is not very high priority.
All right, sir. Well, thank you very much for your observations.
No
problem. Let's go to the WhatsApp before. The person's making a note here that they want to compare the cell phone fines with the fines given to those who ride bicycles, or rather who are caught doing wheelies on the road and drag races and doing stunts. Mm-hmm. And they say that it's $500 and no confinement. They're also questioning about the act whereby cyclists are now supposed to be wearing helmets, or this mm-hmm. is just for children. I thought it was just for children. I'm really not sure with that. But while you consult the act there, let's go back to the phone lines.
It's not just children.
It's not just children.
No.
So you're saying bicyclists, all bicyclists?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who rides a bicycle on our roads is supposed to get a helmet?
Yes. Once they're riding on a road or a highway. And it has to be, the chin strap has to be securely fastened. And it is correct. Yes, it applies to.
And if you fail to, well. is there a lead time, like a grace period, or this is now the law? So everybody is supposed to be wearing a helmet as long as they're riding on the road.
Yes, that's correct. It's not the law.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't know that, you know it now.
Yes, and
what is the fine? If
$300.
$300. So if you ride a bicycle on the street, adult or child, and you're not wearing a helmet, the fine is now $300.
In relation to stunts, it isn't that there is no